The first time I understood what he could do to me, it wasn't loud. It wasn't a threat. It was an invitation that arrived like a compliment and landed like a test. A drink after work. A private meeting that didn't need to be private. A hand resting where it didn't belong. Like he'd already decided my body was part of the job description. I said no once, calmly, clearly, with the kind of politeness women learn early so men don't turn sharp. Nothing changed on paper after that. My title stayed the same, my target stayed the same, my performance reviews still used the same glowing adjectives. But doors stopped opening. Meetings happened without me. Decisions got made in rooms I wasn't invited into. My name got left off threads that used to depend on me. It was like the company discovered a new way to punish someone without leaving fingerprints. And the worst part was how normal everyone acted while it happened, like I was imagining the whole thing. I used to love the building. It was one of those polished glass blocks in the city that tried to look more international than it needed to. All clean lines and muted colors. A reception desk that felt like a customs checkpoint, and a quiet hum of money moving from one decision to another. Vienna makes it easy to believe in systems. It teaches you to trust the order of things. You take pride in structure here, in rules, in the idea that everything has a reason and a process and a paper trail. I believed in that. I'd been with the company long enough to know which rules mattered and which ones were just for decoration. I'd learned the rhythm of quarterly pressure, the seasonal panic before audits, the small internal wars disguised as alignment. I was good at it. Not just competent, good. The kind of person people came to when something needed to be fixed quietly before it became a headline. I wasn't the loudest in the room. I wasn't the one who performed ambition with sharp suits and big laughs. I did my work. I made other people look good without making myself small. And I kept receipts in my head even when I didn't keep them on paper. That's why the promotion felt inevitable. It wasn't a fantasy. It was the next step that made sense. I'd already been doing the work unofficially. I was the one shepherding projects across departments, the one translating executive chaos into timelines and deliverables, the one smoothing over friction so the outcomes looked effortless. When the role opened, people started saying things like, "It's basically yours." They said it with that Austrian certainty that feels like a stamp. And then he started orbiting me. He was not a stranger. We'd been in the same company, the same ecosystem, long enough to develop the kind of familiarity that's supposed to be safe. He wasn't a boss in the formal sense, not yet, but he had influence that was worse because it wasn't printed anywhere. He sat close to the decision makers. He was the kind of man who could walk into an executive office without knocking and come out smiling, like the walls recognized him. He had that comfortable confidence men get when the world has mostly agreed with them. White, Austrian, mid-30s, polished but casual, the kind of face that looked trustworthy in a recruitment brochure. He didn't need to prove he belonged. He acted like belonging was his birthright. At first, his attention seemed flattering in the way attention always pretends to be. He'd stop by my desk longer than necessary. He'd ask my opinion on things he didn't actually need help with. He'd make small jokes that were just on the edge of personal, testing the air, seeing if I'd laugh in a way that invited more. I tried to keep it clean, professional, warm, but not open. I didn't want enemies. I didn't want rumors. I didn't want to be the woman who made a problem where there wasn't one. But there was one. I could feel it growing. It's hard to describe to someone who hasn't lived inside it. It's not one moment. It's a pattern. The slight lean too close. The private compliments that had nothing to do with work. The way he'd lower his voice as if we were sharing something secret, when all we were sharing was office air. He'd say I was different. He'd say he trusted me more than most people. He'd say he wanted to make sure I got what I deserved. That last one landed wrong in my body. The first time he said it, something in me went cold because I heard what was underneath. I wanted to believe it was harmless. I wanted to tell myself I was being dramatic. I'm Austrian too. I'm not naive. I'm not fresh out of university. I know the world. I know men. I also know how quickly an atmosphere can become a trap. The company liked to talk about integrity. There were posters in the break rooms about respect and inclusion. There were mandatory trainings with slick videos and multiple choice questions that made harassment feel like a theoretical problem other companies had. But the real company didn't live in posters. It lived in who got invited to lunch, who got pulled into quick sinks, who got looped in when there was an opportunity. It lived in the informal channels that never got archived. The warning signs were small enough to ignore, which is exactly why they worked. He started arranging meetings with me that didn't have agendas. He'd ask if I had time for a quick coffee in one of the smaller conference rooms, the ones with frosted glass that made everything look private, even when it wasn't. He didn't say anything overt at first. He didn't touch me. He didn't write anything you could forward to HR. He just shifted the air. He'd ask about my weekend in a way that lingered. He'd ask if I lived alone. He'd comment on my dress, my hair, my perfume, the things that never belonged in a workplace conversation. He'd keep smiling like it was all casual, like I would be crazy to make it heavy. And then he made it heavy. It happened on a Thursday, late, when most of the floor had thinned out. The company liked to pretend we had work-life balance, but everyone who mattered stayed late when there was pressure, and there was always pressure. He came by my desk when I was still typing, and he asked if I could step into a meeting room for a minute. His voice was relaxed, like he was asking for a file. I followed because it felt easier than saying no. Inside the room, he closed the door with a gentleness that felt rehearsed. He leaned against the table, not sitting, taking up space without effort. He started talking about the promotion as if it were already decided. He said the leadership team respected me. He said my work spoke for itself. Then he said he wanted to celebrate privately, just the two of us, somewhere nicer than the office, somewhere without people watching. I remember the exact moment my stomach dropped because I understood the script. I understood that this wasn't a celebration. It was a transaction disguised as romance. I kept my face calm. I told him I wasn't interested. I said it clearly. I didn't flirt. I didn't soften it into a joke. I didn't leave room for misinterpretation. He smiled anyway. He said he admired me for being direct. He said he liked a woman who knew what she wanted. He said it didn't have to be complicated. Then he stepped closer, close enough that I could smell his cologne, close enough that the air in the room felt like it was being used against me. He didn't grab me. He didn't pin me. He just moved into the space where I'd have to react. I took a step back. I told him again, no. I said I wanted to keep things professional. Something changed in his eyes. Not anger, not yet. More like a calculation, like he was adjusting his approach. He said I was making a mistake. He said people like me didn't get opportunities like this twice. He said he could help me, and he could also stop helping me. He didn't say it like a threat. He said it like a fact, the way men say facts when they assume you'll accept them. I felt my throat tighten, the way it does when you're trying to keep control of your voice. I told him I was leaving. I reached for the door. He didn't block me. He didn't need to. He let me go like I was already punished. When I got back to my desk, my hands were shaking just enough that I had to hide them under the table. I sat there pretending to work while my whole body hummed with the awareness that I had stepped on something invisible and dangerous. The next day, he sent an email about a project, perfectly normal, no trace of what had happened. He copied me the way he always did. He signed off politely. It was like the meeting room never existed. I tried to tell myself it was over, but I knew better. Because I know how some men handle rejection. They don't always explode. The smart ones don't. The smart ones punish you slowly, in ways that make you doubt your own reality. And he was smart. It started with silence, not the obvious kind, not the kind you can point to and say, there, that's retaliation. It was subtle, the kind of silence that only matters if you know what your place used to be. The weekly strategy meeting happened without me. I found out because a colleague mentioned a decision that had been made, and my name was not part of the conversation. At first, I assumed it was a mistake. I asked for the notes. I asked who was running point. I kept my tone light, like I wasn't accusing anyone. My colleague looked uncomfortable. He said he thought I was busy. He said he assumed someone told me. He said it casually, but I saw the small panic in his eyes. The panic of someone who realizes they've stepped into something they don't understand. I checked my calendar, no invite. I checked my emails, nothing. I checked the shared agenda, my section had been removed. I told myself it was an oversight. I told myself not to spiral. Then it happened again. A vendor call I'd been leading for months suddenly had a new owner. I was still invited, but my role had shifted. I was there to listen, not to lead. They introduced the new person as if it were natural, as if I'd volunteered to step back. I sat through it smiling, my jaw clenched so hard my teeth hurt. After the call, I asked my manager what was happening. My manager wasn't an enemy. She was just cautious. The kind of woman who had survived by staying agreeable, by never getting too close to conflict. She said priorities were shifting. She said leadership wanted to streamline. She said, I shouldn't take it personally. I nodded, because what else could I do in that moment? It's hard to fight a fog. It's hard to argue against a vibe. The promotion process became a slow, distorted mirror. On paper, I was still the strongest candidate. On paper, I was still performing. My KPIs were solid. My feedback was positive. My deliverables were clean. But in the real company, the one that mattered, my presence started fading. He didn't stop talking to me. That was the cruel part. He kept stopping by my desk, still smiling, still friendly. He'd ask about my workload. He'd offer support. He'd say things like, let me know if you need anything. And every time, I felt my skin tighten because I could hear the unspoken meaning. Let me know if you're ready to change your mind. I started avoiding being alone with him. I kept my office door open. I timed my breaks. I chose the busier elevators. I became a strategist in my own safety, mapping the building like a war zone. It made me tired. It made me angry in a way I couldn't express, because the anger had nowhere safe to go. The worst part wasn't even him, it was everyone else. People started treating me like I was difficult without anyone saying it outright. The same colleagues who used to lean on me began hesitating before asking for my help. Invitations to informal gatherings dried up. People kept conversations shorter around me, like my presence carried a risk they didn't want to touch. At first, I wondered if he had said something about me. Then I realized he didn't have to. All he had to do was shift his own behavior publicly. All he had to do was withdraw his support in spaces where it mattered, and everyone else would follow the scent. Power doesn't need to speak, it just needs to move. The promotion timeline stretched, the role stayed under review. Meetings about the role kept happening without me. I'd hear about them afterward in fragments. Someone mentioning a candidate, someone mentioning an interview stage I never got. I requested a formal check-in about my career progression. I framed it carefully, like a professional. I talked about growth. I talked about readiness. I talked about my contributions. I used the language the company liked. I got vague answers. They said they were still assessing. They said the role might be rescoped. They said there were considerations beyond performance. Considerations. That word became a weapon. It meant everything and nothing. It meant they could deny me without naming why. I started documenting, not in a dramatic way. Quietly, I kept dates, I kept emails, I kept notes about missed invites, about role changes, about decisions I was suddenly excluded from. Every time I did it, I felt ridiculous, like I was building a case for something I wasn't sure I'd ever have the courage to bring. But my instincts were screaming. My instincts were telling me that if I didn't track it, I'd be trapped in other people's narratives. Then he tested me again. One evening, he caught me near the elevators when the hallway was empty and the lights made everything look late and private. He walked beside me like it was coincidence. He asked how I was doing. He said he noticed things felt a bit different lately. I didn't answer the way he wanted. I kept it neutral. I said work was busy. He smiled and said he hated seeing me stressed. He said it was a shame because I deserved better support. He said he could make things easier for me if I let him. I felt heat rise up my chest. My hands clenched around my laptop bag. I wanted to say something sharp. I wanted to call him what he was. I wanted to spit the truth into his face so it couldn't hide behind politeness anymore. Instead, I did what so many women do in that moment. I controlled myself. I chose survival. I told him I didn't need anything. I told him I was fine. I said good night and stepped into the elevator. My heart hammered as the doors closed because the message was clear. He wasn't even pretending it was about attraction anymore. He was making the transaction explicit without giving me a single sentence I could quote. That's what makes it so effective. That's what makes it so hard to fight. I thought about going to HR. I pictured the meeting, the clean office, the concerned expressions, the careful questions, the way they'd ask me for specifics. What did he say exactly? When did he say it? Do you have it in writing? I imagined myself explaining the atmosphere, the implications, the way his power moved through the building like perfume, the way my career was being strangled without a single hand on my throat. I imagined them nodding politely and then doing nothing, or worse, labeling me as a problem employee. HR isn't built to protect people. It's built to protect companies. I knew that. I'd seen it. Not in dramatic scandals, but in small, quiet tragedies where someone got managed out because they made leadership uncomfortable. So I tried another approach. I went to my manager again. I didn't mention him directly at first. I described what was happening in terms of process breakdown, exclusions, lack of communication, shifting responsibilities without explanation. She listened. She looked genuinely uncomfortable. She said she'd raise it. Days passed, nothing changed. Then she pulled me aside one afternoon with a strained smile and said, "Leadership was concerned about my fit for the next level." She said there were worries about my collaboration style. Collaboration style, another weapon. I asked what that meant. I asked for examples. I asked for feedback I could act on. She couldn't give me anything concrete. She said it was just the perception. Perception is what happens when people talk about you without you in the room. Perception is what grows when power wants you smaller. I could feel myself becoming the story they were telling. I started losing sleep, not because I doubted my work, but because I couldn't predict the next move. I couldn't tell where the sabotage would come from. A missed invite, a reassigned task, a whispered comment in a leadership meeting. I started second-guessing every decision, every email, every meeting. I became hyper-aware of my tone, my face, my body language. I tried to be perfect in a way that felt humiliating. I tried to remove every possible excuse they could use against me. And still, it kept happening. The promotion went to someone else, not a catastrophe on paper. They framed it as a strategic decision. They said the chosen candidate had broader stakeholder management experience, even though I had been managing stakeholders for years. I sat in the meeting where they informed me, smiling so hard it hurt. I thanked them for the consideration. I asked for development feedback, like a good employee. Inside, something cracked. Afterward, he walked past my desk and gave me a sympathetic look that made my stomach turn. He didn't say anything. He didn't need to. The look was the message. See? This is what happens when you don't play along. I remember going to the bathroom and standing in a stall, breathing through my nose because I didn't want to cry loud enough for someone to hear. I remember staring at the tile and thinking, this is what retaliation looks like when it's done by someone who knows the rules. I also remember the rage. It wasn't the explosive kind. It was colder. It was the realization that my professionalism was being used as a cage, that my restraint was part of what kept me vulnerable, that the company would rather sacrifice me than admit what was happening. I made choices I never thought I'd make. I started talking to people outside my department, quietly, carefully, not gossip, just questions. I asked who had been in the decision meetings. I asked what was said about me. I asked what concerns were raised. The answers came in fragments, like broken glass. Someone said there were questions about my temperament. Someone said I was seen as too intense. Someone said leadership felt I wasn't aligned. No one could point to a mistake. No one could point to a failure. Just vague character judgments that sounded like someone had planted a seed. And I knew exactly whose seed it was. I wanted to confront him. I wanted to stand in front of him and say, "You did this because I wouldn't give you what you wanted." But confronting men like him is like confronting smoke. He would deny it. He would smile. He would make me sound unstable. He would make me look like a woman scorned, which is the oldest insult in the book. So I kept my head down and sharpened my strategy. I began building my exit before I admitted to myself that I needed one. When you lose something like that, you don't just lose a promotion. You lose a version of yourself. You lose the self that believed hard work was a shield. You lose the self that trusted process. You lose the self that thought if you stayed professional enough, no one could touch you. After the promotion decision, my world in the company became smaller. They didn't fire me. That would have been messy. That would have required reasons. They did something cleaner. They made me irrelevant. Projects I had built were assigned elsewhere. People stopped consulting me. My manager stopped bringing me into discussions where strategy was shaped. I became the person you copy out of habit and then remove when it's time for the real conversation. At first, I fought it. I tried to reclaim ground. I asked to lead new initiatives. I volunteered. I offered solutions. I stayed late. I made myself visible in the ways they claim they want. It didn't matter, because visibility only counts if the right people are looking. He had won, not by destroying me publicly, but by rearranging the environment until I couldn't breathe. The strangest thing was how normal the company looked from the outside. We still had town halls. We still had newsletters about culture and well-being. We still had smiling photos of leadership talking about empowerment, about integrity, about respect. I would sit in those meetings with my face calm and my throat tight, watching people clap for values they didn't practice. I stopped eating lunch with colleagues. Not because I wanted to isolate, but because I couldn't handle the performance anymore. I couldn't stand pretending I was fine while I felt myself being slowly erased. I also couldn't tell anyone the real story. Not cleanly. Not in a way that would be believed without being twisted. If I said he blocked my promotion because I rejected him, people would look for proof. They would look for messages. They would look for a dramatic moment. They would want it to look like a movie. But the truth didn't look like a movie. It looked like meetings I wasn't invited into. It looked like missing calendar requests. It looked like vague feedback about fit. It looked like a man who smiled at me while he quietly moved his hand over my career, like he was turning down a volume. The company could always claim it was about business needs. And that's why this kind of punishment works. It hides inside plausible deniability. It thrives on politeness. It uses professionalism as the rope. I did go to HR eventually, not because I believed they'd save me, but because I couldn't stand feeling powerless anymore. I requested a confidential conversation. I prepared carefully. I didn't lead with emotion. I led with patterns. I laid out the timeline, the initiating meeting, the subsequent exclusions, the shift in responsibilities, the promotion decision, the vague feedback, the repeated offers of support that were clearly conditional. I spoke like someone presenting a case they already knew might be dismissed. HR listened with that trained neutrality that makes you feel like you're speaking into foam. They asked questions that sounded supportive, but felt like they were building a defense for the company. They asked if I had witnesses. They asked if he had touched me. They asked if he had explicitly threatened me. I said no, not in those terms. I said it was the pattern. I said it was the implication. I said it was retaliation without a sentence I could quote. They nodded. They said they took concerns seriously. They said they would look into it. Then the real punishment arrived. Not immediate, not dramatic, just a subtle increase in pressure. My manager became cooler with me. My workload shifted again, suddenly heavier in ways that didn't lead anywhere. I was assigned tasks that were visible but meaningless, the corporate equivalent of busy work. People who used to be friendly began watching their words around me. It was as if filing the complaint had turned me into an infection. HR never told me the outcome. They never named any action. They said confidentiality prevented them from sharing details. They said they had addressed the situation appropriately. Nothing changed. He still walked through the office like a man untouched by consequence. He still spoke in meetings with ease. He still had access to rooms I couldn't enter. If anything, he looked more relaxed, like the complaint had confirmed what he already knew, that the system would protect him. There's a particular kind of humiliation in realizing that you've done everything right and still lost. I had been professional. I had been clear. I had refused him without cruelty. I had done my job well. I had followed process. And the cost of my no had been months of being slowly cut down. I started questioning myself in ugly ways. I wondered if I should have laughed it off differently. I wondered if I should have pretended not to notice. I wondered if I should have accepted the drink, the dinner, the implied transaction, and then managed it quietly, the way some women do when they decide their career matters more than their comfort. That thought made me sick, because it wasn't really mine. It was the company's thought, implanted in me like a virus. This is what they do. They make you consider betraying yourself as a survival tactic. I didn't want to become that kind of person, so I chose the one thing I could still control. I left. It wasn't immediate. I didn't storm out. I didn't slam a resignation letter on a desk. That would have made me feel powerful for a day and unemployed the next. I planned my exit like a strategist. I updated my CV quietly. I reached out to contacts I trusted. I took interviews during lunch breaks and early mornings. I smiled in the office while building a different life outside it. When I finally had an offer, I felt a wave of relief so intense it almost knocked me over. I gave notice with a calmness that surprised even me. My manager looked shocked, then disappointed, then polite. She asked why. I gave a professional explanation about growth and opportunity, because telling the truth would have been messy and pointless. HR asked me to do an exit interview. I agreed, because a part of me still wanted to leave a mark, even if it was only a scratch on a system that would keep moving. In the interview, I said enough to be clear without sounding emotional. I said I felt my career progression had been impacted by informal power dynamics. I said I had experienced retaliation after setting a boundary. I said the company's processes did not protect employees from that kind of behavior. The HR representative nodded and took notes. I could see in their face that they were already filing my words into a category that would keep the company safe. A category called unhappy employee. A category called difficult situation. A category called no actionable evidence. Still, I said it. I said it because silence always has a cost, and I was tired of paying it alone. On my last day, he came by my desk. He smiled. He wished me luck. He said it was a shame to lose someone like me. I looked at him and felt something almost peaceful. Not because I had forgiven him, not because I believed in justice, but because I had finally stopped hoping the company would do the right thing. I realized he didn't need to ruin me completely. He just needed to teach me a lesson. He needed to remind me where power lived. And the lesson was simple. In places like that, your no is not always treated as a boundary. Sometimes it's treated as a challenge. I walked out of the building with my box of things and the cold winter air on my face, and I felt grief for what I'd lost, but also a sharp clarity. I wasn't leaving because I couldn't handle the work. I was leaving because I refused to let a man's ego become the ceiling over my life. Months later, I still think about it. Not every day. Not obsessively. But sometimes in quiet moments, I remember the way the doors closed so softly I almost convinced myself they hadn't. I remember how quickly people adjusted to my absence from rooms I used to belong in. I remember how easily leadership accepted a narrative about me that had no evidence. I remember how the company's values were just words until they threatened someone with real influence. I also remember my own voice in that meeting room, the one where I said no, and I hold on to that. Because that no cost me something. It cost me time, reputation, comfort, momentum, but it also proved something, that I was still mine, that even when the system protected him, it didn't own me. And that is not a clean victory. It doesn't feel triumphant. It feels like residue. It feels like walking away with your dignity intact and realizing dignity doesn't pay bonuses, doesn't get you invited to the meeting, doesn't stop the whisper networks. But it does something else. It keeps you from disappearing inside someone else's control. And after everything he did, after months of punishment, dressed up as process, that mattered more than any title they could have offered me.